Hi, Marco Werman here. Before we get to the show, time is running out to make your gift before our fundraiser ends on December 31st. If you've already donated to our nonprofit newsroom this year, thank you. You make it possible for us to do this very important work, to bring human-centered coverage from all around the globe to your ears every single weekday, to bring you stories straight from lived experience from the people who are impacted the most, and to broaden your horizons and keep you connected to the world beyond our borders. If you have not given yet, this is your chance. By making a gift, you're not only helping our newsroom flourish, you're also paying it forward for your fellow listeners who are not in a position to donate right now. Please make your gift today to sustain our nonprofit newsroom. You can head to theworld.org/give to donate and learn more. That's theworld.org/give. Now, the show. Last night in Hong Kong, authorities took down a famous monument. It commemorated the 1989 Tiananmen Massacre.
They can destroy the monument, but deep inside everybody's heart, it will never be destroyed.
Also on the show, Libya had been planning to take an important step towards stability, an election, but it's now been called off.
It's very much a moment characterized by its uncertainty, radical uncertainty.
And coastal cities, climate change, and sea level rise. South Korea has one idea: build a city that floats. It's not so crazy.
It's not going to feel like a ship. It's going to rock a lot less. It shouldn't be like going on to the moon or be something completely new for us.
And at-home COVID tests, hard to find here, but not everywhere on the planet. Today, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us today. As we enter one of the busiest travel weeks of the year, there's one crucial product right now that is in very short supply. I'm talking about at-home rapid tests for COVID. Many health professionals say taking these tests is a good way to keep holiday gatherings safe. But good luck finding a test. And if you can, they're often not cheap. Irene Bosch is a disease expert at MIT who spent much of her career developing rapid tests for tropical diseases. Once a pandemic hit, she turned her attention to COVID. So let's just set a baseline, Irene. What are the basic differences between a rapid test and kind of the gold standard PCR test that you might get at a pharmacy or administered by a local government?
So a very big difference is that the rapid tests are very small, nimble, and you can have your results right in front of your eyes in about 5 to 15 minutes. So that does not happen with PCR that requires that you extract the material of the virus and then run it in a machine and then wait for your results.
There are lots of different at-home tests. You're working on a project right now to look at different rapid tests from around the globe to see which ones can be best used to keep communities safe. You've been looking at rapid tests from Britain, Germany, India and Korea that are not yet approved in the U.S. How good are these tests? Are they really different from what we have here?
Yeah, no, they're fundamentally the same. So far, all the ones that we picked are highly performing tests. They would pass any kind of like regulatory agency asking, but they have not applied or have not gotten the FDA USA permits.
Are these tests from other places in the world cheaper than what we have here?
Yeah, certainly they are. To make really a test could be 50 cents to maybe a dollar, but no more. It's what we call affordable technology, high-performing technology. So for pandemics, you should not have any impediment to have a really low-cost, less than $4 test. It's totally doable.
So in your opinion, how important is cost when it comes to using tests as a public health measure?
It's huge because you need to introduce the concept of frequency of use because of the large amount of asymptomatics. They'll never show up in a line for testing in a hospital. They stay home and they'll contaminate everybody around them. So the nature of COVID itself requires frequency as a mitigation tool. And that frequency is like almost brushing your teeth. You have to get used to it. You can do it as frequent as once a week, twice a week, depending on how many cases your community has. If your toothpaste would cost $100, how many people will brush their teeth? Probably much less.
So why are tests so expensive and hard to get in the U.S. right now compared to other countries in Europe and Asia?
That's a great question, because in other countries, the regulatory body did it differently. They understood really early on that you had to put these in the hands of people. So regulatory bodies there authorized the commercialization of tests over the counter. whether in the United States, that process was very sort of difficult and still very difficult. And until we solve that and let the great number of tests to come in, we will be in jeopardy. So one solution could be to work closely with regulatory agencies to understand that this is a life-saving tool, mitigation tool, monitoring tool, but not just diagnostic tool, which is all what FDA does here is to name it medical diagnostic.
Well, as you know, President Biden announced this week that 500 million more at-home tests would be distributed by mail starting in January. What difference do you think that could make in the U.S. to stop the spread of Omicron?
It's a good intention. It's a start, but definitely not the way it should be done, because it's just basically a probability issue. Right now, we are in a peak, and we might have other peaks for sure. So under the peak, you have to test at least once a week, everybody. So the 500 million does not cover once a week for the whole population of the United States. One of the really good things that the government could do is to open the door to very safe, good tests that are already permitted in the Europe market and in Asia market, and they're excellent. Not in a month, but like today, like Christmas Day, there's an announcement that more tests will come from Europe and Asia. That would be a game changer.
Irene Bosch is a disease expert at MIT and specializes in rapid tests. Irene, thank you very much for helping us better understand these home rapid tests.
Oh, thank you.
Spin back to September and the migrants huddling in terrible conditions under a bridge near the border between Mexico and Texas. Many of those people were from Haiti, who were subsequently deported by Washington. Now a group of Haitians is suing the American government. They're asking to be brought back to the U.S. The World's Daisy Contreras has more.
The images were startling. Thousands of migrants under the Del Rio International Bridge had set up makeshift tents. It was sweltering hot and crowded. Jacques, who's 25, remembers it well. It was really hard to see how we were living, he says. Border Patrol agents barely gave us food, water, or medical treatment. Jacques left Haiti in 2019 because he refused to join a gang, so gang members threatened to kill him. He still fears for his safety, so he asked to use his first name only. After leaving Haiti, Jacques went to Brazil and then tried reaching the U.S. to seek asylum in September. After he spent a week at the camp, Jacques says he was held at two different immigration detention centers. Then he was deported to Haiti. Once on the airplane, the agents never told us where we were going, he says. Now, Jacques and 10 other Haitian migrants are suing the U.S. government. Some, like Jacques, are back in Haiti. Others are in Mexico. They argue that immigration officials violated their right to seek a safer life in the U.S. They want the government to let them return and request asylum. They also want someone to take responsibility for how they were treated at the bridge in Texas, the lack of food, shelter, and medical attention. Around the time Jacques was deported, Border Patrol agents also faced another problem.
Questions tonight about this video appearing to show Border Patrol agents confronting refugees aggressively on the Rio Grande.
Weekend, images were published on Border Patrol on horseback.
On TV, U.S. officials were seen pushing back Haitian migrants. Border Patrol union leaders say agents were doing their job and following a policy invoked by the Trump administration at the start of the pandemic. It lets U.S. immigration officials automatically turn away asylum seekers at the border. President Joe Biden reacted to criticism over how Haitians were being treated.
Of course, I take responsibility. I'm president, but it was horrible what to see, as you saw. To see people treated like they did, horses barely running them over, people being strapped, it's outrageous. I promise you, those people will pay.
The Department of Homeland Security is still investigating what happened. The agency, which oversees Border Patrol, didn't respond to a request for comment. Immigration lawyer Karen Tumlin says the administration clearly violated people's rights. She's part of the team representing Jacques and the other migrants.
Presently, even though seeking asylum is legal and is a human right, there is no legal path for Jacques or anyone who is fleeing persecution and even death to properly seek and assert those legal rights that they have in the United States.
Gerlene Joseph leads the nonprofit Haitian Bridge Alliance. It's helping Haitians at the border. She's criticized the U.S. government for a history of disproportionately sending back Haitian migrants while allowing in people from other countries.
We clearly want to make sure that we cannot separate the fact that racism is a part and at the root of the way that they acted and reacted to the Haitian migrants.
Joseph says the lawsuit could take months, maybe a year, to go through the courts. Now, back in Haiti, Jacques says he's still in hiding. He can't return to his hometown because he's still facing death threats from the gangs that wanted to recruit him. He says asylum in the U.S. is his only chance at a safer life. If the lawsuit he's a part of now goes in his favor, he may have a chance of seeking that. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
If all goes according to plan, there will be a new city off the coast of South Korea by the year 2025. Residents there will get their power from clean energy. And when sea levels rise, the city will also rise. That's because this will be a floating community. That's the objective, anyway, for this eco-friendly floating city of the future. The World's Patrick Nguyen has our report.
The first question I have about life on a floating town, will it feel like you're on a boat? Will it be weird?
It's not going to feel like a ship. It's going to rock a lot less. It shouldn't be like going on to the moon or be something completely new for us.
Mark Collins Chin is the co-founder of Oceanics, the company that's building this town. Its first floating platform will likely cost about $200 million, all privately raised. South Korea will let Chin's team place it off the southern coast by the city of Busan. And it will be governed by Korea. It won't be some independent floating republic.
It absolutely is under the laws, rules, regulations of not only Busan, but also central government.
So how to imagine this floating city? Start by picturing a giant hexagon-shaped platform in the water, about the size of a block in New York City.
You're not going to see these huge avenues, you know, like a Fifth Avenue running right through the middle of a floating city.
Most people would walk, bike, or use electric vehicles. Many homes would be made of wood. As for power, it would likely use a mix of wind and solar or tapping the tidal currents. Chin says you shouldn't see power cables running from the mainland.
We see these platforms as not being parasites to the city. So yes, no power lines is our objective.
Here is the extraordinary thing about this concept. It would start as one platform, then they plan to add more and more, bunching them together to make a real city. But Chin says later on, you could unhook them and move them around.
You can move neighborhoods. You can move entire parts of the cities to other parts. I'm not saying this is easy, but it is something that is planned for.
Imagine moving Little Italy over to link up with the Upper West Side. The fact that these platforms are free-floating, that is really the whole point. Because rising seas, it's coming. Mark Collins Chin knows all about it. He's from French Polynesia, where he used to be tourism minister. That whole island nation could be submerged this century. He says humans have to figure out how to make cities that are impervious to rising seawater.
It is a necessity today because there's not a coastal town, a coastal city, a coastal community, a coastal indigenous group that is not concerned with sea level rise.
Now Chin's company, Oceanics, has to prove this can actually work. What about food, I ask? He says a lot will come from the mainland, but there would also be aquaponic fish farms and communal gardens, too. Okay, another quick question. What about sewage?
Oh, that's not a quick one.
Chin says they're looking at Namibia, a country in Africa, where much of the sewage is transformed into drinking water using this special bacteria. They've done this for 50 years. Apparently, it tastes fine. But there will be another source of drinking water.
Anything that rains on our platform is captured. It doesn't just roll off into a gutter and into the ocean, as in most cities with asphalt, right?
The company is still in its design stage, but Chin says they do want to start building the first platform next year. The whole project will be monitored by the United Nations, a division called UN Habitat that works on sustainable housing. South Korea is a good place to start, Chin says. It has great engineers and a government that wants to stay on the cutting edge. The Oceanics team is also talking to at least 10 other city governments in the Middle East, Africa, Europe, and Asia. Chin wouldn't say which ones, but the long-term plans sound really ambitious.
Our objectives are hopefully in 40 years to see a billion, with a B, a billion people living on sustainable floating cities around the world.
Well, the project will start with 300 Koreans. That's how many people can live on one floating city hexagon. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In the dead of night, authorities in Hong Kong dismantled and carted off a well-known sculpture on the campus of the University of Hong Kong. It's called the Pillar of Shame, a 26-foot-high work in copper commemorating the victims of the Tiananmen Square massacre in Beijing in 1989. Casey Wong was an assistant professor of art and design at Hong Kong Polytechnic University. He's in exile in Taiwan, where he's been for 4 months. Casey, can you start by describing this sculpture for us?
Well, it's a obelisk painted in orange with a lot of tormented heads and bodies stacked on top of each other. In the bottom, there is a scripture saying, "The old shall not kill the young." And it is a commemoration of the 1989 Tiananmen massacre. It was placed in Hong Kong University for almost a quarter of a century.
And for you as an artist and an art professor, what does it mean to you just personally?
Well, for me, it sounds like a murderer trying to eradicate his crime by violently destroying the monument and hoping that no one will remember his crime. And also it sounds like a grave robbery because the monument actually signifies some kind of tombstone to commemorate the brave young ones who once fought with their life for freedom and democracy. To destroy that and cut it in half in the middle of the night is a desecration of the graveyard.
When you first saw this work of art, Casey, what did it mean to you?
At that time, 1997, Hong Kong was still open to the Western world, and what's going on in mainland China, it seems very remote to us. So when this Pillar of Shame came to Hong Kong, I look at it as kind of grotesque, to tell you the truth. But as the political pressure started building up in Hong Kong, and we got our own fair share of oppression, it wasn't so grotesque anymore, and I can totally sympathize with the young people of mainland China who were fighting for democracy.
Well, as you say, we know that Beijing has been restricting freedoms in Hong Kong for several years. Hong Kong officials, though, had been threatening this move for a long time. What triggered this removal earlier today in Hong Kong?
As a matter of fact, the creator of the Pillar of Shame, Jens Gottschall, the Danish artist, well, 3 months ago, he received a lawyer's letter from the University of Hong Kong telling him that the university will be taking down the sculpture. But unfortunately, the political organization who originally organized the sculpture are in jail right now. So the artist took up the responsibility to negotiate with the university, and the lawyer firm, which is an American firm representing University of Hong Kong, quit after the artist protests against the law firm. And then the artist trying to tell the University of Hong Kong to try to come up with a resolution to peacefully take down the sculpture and have it transport out of Hong Kong. But all these peaceful resolution was basically ignored by the University of Hong Kong. And then last night, the university sets up all these plastic barriers and then a gigantic piece of white cloth covering the sculpture, and the sculpture was cut in half in the middle of the night.
Did authorities give a reason why they were taking it down?
They did after and during the demolition. They said, well, the sculpture is old and might be potentially dangerous, as well as it infringed on the national security.
What are you hearing from Hong Kong about reaction from residents there to the removal of this work of art?
Well, right now it's awfully quiet, to tell you the truth. The passing of the national security law becomes this really ugly weapon against civic society. People are so afraid of speaking the truth because the price to pay is very high. So a lot of people just keep quiet, even in the social media.
Do any other public memorials to the Tiananmen Square massacre remain in Hong Kong, or perhaps more nuanced works of art that you fear might be targeted?
As Jens, the artist, put it, one can see this demolition as the beginning of the Hong Kong Cultural Revolution. Because Jens have already informed the university that the piece of artwork belongs to him, and it's a violation of personal property rights. And if we look at what happened in mainland China during the 60s, during the Cultural Revolution, we see temples being destroyed, monuments being destroyed, and this total disregardless of personal ownership. So I'm afraid this kind of cultural destruction will continue, unfortunately.
I mean, to say a new cultural revolution, that of course implies not just forceful messaging and removal of art, but also violence. What do you foresee?
Well, the violence that we have already experienced during the 2019 anti-extradition law movements, a lot of youngsters being beaten up. Right now, the people of Hong Kong felt like they're under this oppression. As we witnessed the recent governance by Xi Jinping, the party is going back to the 60s, the hardcore communism. So I think the future is very, very grim. But they can destroy the monument, but deep inside everybody's heart, it will never be destroyed. And people will remember.
Casey Wong speaking with us from Taiwan, where he's in self-exile. He was an assistant professor of art and design at Hong Kong Polytechnic University, speaking with us today about the removal of a sculpture in Hong Kong, a public memorial to the victims of the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre in Beijing. Casey, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We've all gotten up in the morning, felt a little off, and thought, you know, I'm calling in sick today. But it's hard to imagine that ever crossed the mind of the police minister for the island nation of Madagascar. After Serge Gelee's helicopter crashed in the Indian Ocean, he swam 12 hours to safety, then recorded this message shortly after.
I'm alive and well. In 24 hours, I can be back at work.
You've been swimming in open ocean for 12 hours and you're all set to go back to the office? Dude, are you kidding me?
I'm not injured, but very cold.
I guess some people are just made of tougher stuff. Gelee was in a helicopter with three other people surveying the site of a shipwreck. There was one other survivor who also swam 12 hours to safety. In another video taken to the hospital, Gelee describes what happened.
Our mission was over. We saw the accident and we were about to go home. But like all accidents, something unexpected happened. Our helicopter may have been caught in a gust of wind or something and fell.
The 57-year-old, yeah, he is 57, he used a helicopter seat as a flotation device, then started swimming. In another video, Gelee's hands are chalky white and wrinkled from all those hours in the water. He stares straight into the camera and says, "My time to die has not come yet." A superhero tagline if ever there was one. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Psychedelics make a comeback with a rush for new mental health treatments.
It's a bit of the Wild West, and we're very, very early on in the game.
First step, legalization. And in Spain, it's that time of year to sing the winning lottery numbers.
4 millones de...
One of the biggest payouts on Earth. All ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Libya was supposed to have an election on Friday. Now it's off. The country had been in civil conflict for more than a year. Since June of 2020, the interim government in Libya has offered some tenuous stability, but with no forthcoming election, that is now under threat. Also an open question, who will lead the country going forward? Jalal Hashoui is a Libya expert at the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime. He joins us from Paris. Jalal, this election day had been set months ago. Is there a simple explanation for why it's been called off?
Well, actually, legally, it was never set by Libyan institutions. It was always a date that was declared and repeated by the international community. But legally speaking, only the parliament in Libya was authorized to confirm it and never did.
So in the months leading up to this, we had heard that there were two leading candidates for president, a Libyan-American warlord, Khalifa Haftar, and Saif Gaddafi, the son of the longtime dictator. Was anyone else in the running?
Well, there were dozens of candidates. One particularly popular figure is the incumbent prime minister, an interim prime minister that originally was not supposed to be allowed to run at all. He had promised in February that he was not going to run, but in the meantime was able to purchase a form of popularity that needs to be acknowledged. If you ask me, I think he's the most popular figure right now. But of course, Saif al-Islam, the son of Muammar Gaddafi, used the electoral context to stage his media comeback. And he did create a sensation. There's a lot of Libyans who are tempted to kind of say that they would vote for him if there were an actual vote. And Marshal Haftar, I don't think he's as popular as you would typically imagine based on the reports of a context that ceased to exist. It's no longer a context of war.
What is the name of the prime minister that you say is pretty popular?
Abdelhamid Dbeibah.
And when does the term of his government expire, and who's going to be in charge after that?
Officially, it was supposed to expire on the 24th of December. You know, we should not imagine that he will disappear all of a sudden on the 25th of December. Some decisions need to be made. Some choices need to be articulated. And it's very much a moment characterized by its uncertainty, radical uncertainty.
So there's got to be a fix by Friday at midnight. I mean, what's at stake?
Well, you know, if you're in the capital, I'm talking about, of course, Abdelhamid Dbeibah. There's a series of armed groups that are deeply committed to defending his interests, who are really on his side. I would like to also tell your listeners that Turkey is still in town. Turkey is a huge military presence, and it's deeply committed to protecting this prime minister that's supposed to, in theory, leave power. So Turkey is very partial, and its side is quite clear. It's to protect the status quo. And on the other side, also within the capital itself, I'm just talking about the Tripoli area here, you have a whole myriad armed groups that are deeply committed to making sure that things are difficult for this guy to stay. They would like to weaken him or, if possible, topple him. So the situation is really fractured in Tripoli.
How concerned are you about the security situation after Friday?
I am concerned because, as I said, there's a clear dichotomy. You know, you have people in favor of the status quo. We have other people. And what I mean by people is really armed actors who are very well organized and ready to move into action, and by taking territory, by exerting pressure on some institutions, by encircling some buildings, make the influence felt and try to kind of push this guy. But you have to add what happens on the international level. You have to also remember that the East is slightly less chaotic than the West, and Field Marshal Haftar kind of looks attractive to those people fighting each other in the West. So it's a very complicated picture.
What does this non-election mean potentially for daily life for Libyans going forward?
As I said, the prime minister that is at the center of such controversy, the one who's trying to stay.
Abdelhamid Dbeibah.
Abdelhamid Dbeibah is supposed to leave, but, you know, in terms of day-to-day affairs, in terms of making sure that the salaries are paid, that fuel is available and imports continue running in and food doesn't experience high inflation. This guy is really closely allied with what I believe is the most powerful person in Libya. And I'm talking about the governor of the central bank, the person who really holds the purse strings. And that combination is quite effective when it comes to running day-to-day things. And if it is disrupted for one reason or other, then ordinary citizens might feel the consequences because things are not going to run as smoothly as they did, relatively speaking, during the year of 2021. You know, right now, I wouldn't want to describe the scenario as like gloom and doom. You know, there's no big war on the horizon. But the deterioration, if it did happen, would take a while. It would probably unfold slowly during the whole year of 2022.
Jalal Hashoui in Paris, he's with the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime, telling us about the postponement of a long-awaited presidential election in Libya. Jalal, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
If there's one subject that's sure to set off fireworks at the dinner table this holiday season, it's punctuation usage. Sure, you got your classic Oxford comma debate. There's always the existential question, can you really overuse the exclamation mark? And if you really want to see sparks fly, bring up the hyphen. This is a punctuation mark that's been hotly disputed for a long time, centuries, in fact. Patrick Cox tackles this in the latest episode of the podcast Subtitle and the story of one woman's enduring belief in the hyphen.
The English-speaking world is divided between people who've never given the hyphen a second thought and people who think about it all the time. Pardis Mahdavi is one of the latter. It springs from her own hyphenated life. Mahdavi is Iranian-American, Iranian-American. In 1979, her parents and grandmother fled the chaos of pre-revolutionary Iran for the United States. Mahdavi was born within weeks of their arrival. They settled uneasily in Minneapolis.
My family always had a bag packed. There was always, you know, a suitcase packed in the corner, ready to go back to Iran.
Meanwhile, Mahdavi's neighbors and millions of other Americans were watching nightly reports of the Iranian revolution. 52 American citizens taken hostage in Tehran and held for more than a year.
My brothers and I were very aware that we were not wanted here in this country. That came to a head when my brother and I came home from school one day and there was a sign and it said, "Burn this house, terrorists live here."
The family moved to California soon after, but the experience left Mahdavi unsure of whether she was American or Iranian. After grad school in the U.S., she traveled to Iran on a series of research trips. She helped officials there design a new school curriculum on sexual and reproductive rights. But the political winds shifted and she was no longer welcome.
I was followed, my phone was tapped, my email was tapped, and then eventually at a certain point, I was actually arrested.
She was deported and stripped of her Iranian citizenship. Whether she liked it or not, Mahdavi was no longer Iranian. But what did that make her? American, as in 100% American, or something else?
That was really the moment where I realized I have to live in that hyphen because I don't fit in either homeland, and there are a lot of hyphenated people like me, and so we can create our own homeland inside this tiny orthographic mark.
Mahdavi started to investigate the hyphen from its beginnings in ancient Greece. The grammarian Dionysius Thrax, who coined it, thought of the hyphen as something that brought words and ideas together. Later, Celtic monks believed the opposite, that the hyphen split up overly long and complex words, and thus began a centuries-long dispute. Does the hyphen unite or divide? This is more than a grammatical parlor game, at least when it comes to hyphenated Americans.
Well, we all came from other places.
This is John Wayne, the one and only. In 1973, the actor released a spoken word recording called The Hyphen. Look at the harm, he said, that this little line has done.
A simple little line, and yet as divisive as a line can get. A crooked cross the Nazis flew, and the Russian hammer and sickle, too. Time bombs in the lives of man. But none of these could ever fan the flames of hatred faster than the hyphen.
Wayne was just the latest in a line of anti-hyphenists that included Presidents Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. The cause was taken up more recently by former Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, a Republican who's also the son of Indian immigrants.
I don't know about you, but I am tired of the hyphenated Americans. We are not African Americans. We're not Asian Americans. We're not rich Americans. We're not poor Americans. We're all Americans. And it's time to stand up to this nonsense.
Some on the political left have stopped using the hyphen too. In fact, it seems to be losing cachet everywhere. The Associated Press, the New York Times, BuzzFeed, they've all dropped the hyphen in terms like African American and Asian American. Lexicographers have noticed, and hyphens have vanished from dictionary spellings of hundreds of words, words that have nothing to do with national allegiance. But Pardis Mahdavi has no intention of dropping her beloved hyphen. For her, the phrase "living in the hyphen" helps make sense of a life in America where you belong and you don't belong simultaneously.
People with hyphenated identities say, actually, no, this is meant to connect, not divide. And this is meant to connect, to create something new, to say, look, I'm not a type of American that is Japanese or a type of Americans that is Chinese, but I am Chinese American, I am African American, I am Iranian American, I am a different type of American.
Today, Mahdavi lives happily hyphenated in Phoenix, where she teaches at Arizona State University. Her latest book, published this year, is called Hyphen. For the World, I'm Patrick Cox.
People all over Spain yesterday were refreshing their browsers or tuning into live TV to hear the winning numbers for the annual Christmas lottery.
Comenzamos. Muchísima suerte a todos.
The lottery has been held every year since 1812, with a total payout of nearly $3 billion this year. It's one of the world's biggest. But as the world's Lucia Benavides reports from Barcelona, its popularity is about more than just the money.
It's the first time Ana Cavaciocchi is participating in the Christmas lottery, commonly referred to as El Gordo, the fat one, because of its big payout. She eyes the numbers at a lottery sales office in Barcelona and quickly sees one she likes.
Este me gusta, ¿eh?
She doesn't know what about it stands out. It's just a feeling, she says. She picks that number and the one next to it and buys one-tenth of a ticket of each. That's because each ticket costs 200 euros, about $220. So most people opt for buying a fraction of a ticket instead, at around $22.
¿Cuánto me puedo ganar exactamente si tengo el ticket?
Before paying, Cavaciocchi asks the lottery office seller, how much can she actually win? Turns out there are thousands of prizes, ranging from around $20 to nearly half a million. That's what's behind the popularity of the Christmas lottery. It's relatively easy to win at least something, so many people participate. And it's a very social event. People often pool their money to buy those 200 euro lottery tickets with friends, colleagues, or co-workers. In the past, entire towns have won together. In the days leading up to the draw, people wait in long lines to buy their lottery ticket. And some vendors are more popular than others. Like El Gato Negro, the Black Cat, in downtown Barcelona. They have sold winning lottery tickets for the big jackpot three times, so people come from all over Spain to buy here, ringing the bell on their way out for good luck, or rubbing their ticket against the ceramic black cat near the door. Teodoro Baró is the owner of El Gato Negro. His great-grandmother bought the store back in 1912.
Es una cosa que está muy arraigada en los españoles y especialmente la lotería de Navidad.
He says playing the Christmas lottery is an essential part of being Spanish.
Tiene este preámbulo que antes de las fiestas ya hay un gran acontecimiento.
It's like a prelude to Christmas, says Baró, and it encapsulates the spirit of the times, full of hope and excitement. Yesterday, the winning numbers were announced in a televised five-hour ceremony, with two girls from a Madrid children's choir singing out the numbers.
86,148.
This year, a majority of tickets for the big prize were sold at a lottery office in the central Madrid train station. One winner said it came at the perfect time, just weeks after her husband lost his job. But Ana Cavaciocchi, who was hoping for beginner's luck, didn't win a thing.
Estuvo divertido jugar y fue bastante emocionante.
It was fun to play, she says, and exciting to follow the results as they came in. Next year, she adds, she'll undoubtedly play again. For The World, I'm Lucia Benavides in Barcelona.
Coming up, turn off your mind and float downstream. Psychedelics are having a moment in Canada and the U.S.
I've never seen anything quite like this in my 4 or 5 decades of being involved in psychiatric drug development.
We'll tell you about the promise, peril, and hurdles behind modern-day psychedelic treatments. Incidentally, if you're looking for some music that is both mesmerizing and peaceful, the world's director and producer, April Peavy, has a recommendation. The recording Suba Says April is one of the most beautiful albums to come out in 2021. It's a collaboration between Cuban pianist Omar Sosa and master kora player Sekou Keita from Senegal. Their song A La Leno is on our newsroom's end-of-year playlist. Check it out on our Twitter feed. We're at The World.
Thank you.
sublime. New music this year from Cuba's Omar Sosa and Senegal's Sekou Keita. You can find that on our Best of 2021 playlist. It's on our Twitter. Again, that's at The World. Public attitudes about psychedelics like LSD and magic mushrooms have run the gamut from the 1960s and giddy acceptance to strong vilification.
This is your brain. This is drugs. This is your brain on drugs. Any questions?
The pendulum appears to be swinging back. We are now in what some people are calling a psychedelic renaissance. There's now promising mental health research on the effects of psychedelics, and companies are betting big that a psychedelics industry is right around the corner, especially in the U.S. and Canada, early hotspots of investment. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
Danny Motika first discovered psychedelics as a teenager in the mid-2000s.
When I was 13 years old, my father was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer. It was quite overwhelming, and I was struggling significantly with depression.
He didn't want to go on antidepressants, so he went on the internet to look for alternative treatments and read that psilocybin mushrooms could be helpful. When he was 15, he managed to get some.
I took them to my dad, and I said, hey, you know, are these safe to eat? And he gave me a safe place in the basement and said, if anything goes wrong, your mom and I are just upstairs. And so when I was 15, I took this dose of mushrooms, and yeah, it completely changed my life.
Today, Motika is the CEO of PsyGen, a psychedelic startup in Calgary, Canada. Psychedelics are illegal in Canada, like they are in much of the world. But some regulators, including in the U.S. and Canada, allow a limited amount of research into them as possible treatments for mental health conditions. PsyGen hopes to start manufacturing small amounts of synthetic psychedelics for scientists early next year.
What we believe, though, is that the research programs will demonstrate that these molecules are efficacious and that likely 5 years or more down the road, we will see a world where these substances are approved for market, and that is when the true market opportunity starts.
An opportunity scientists, entrepreneurs, and investors have been waiting for many years. In the 1950s and 60s, researchers were hopeful about results from early studies into how psychedelics could be used to treat depression, anxiety, and other mental health disorders. But then the drugs became associated with 1960s counterculture, student riots, and anti-war demonstrations. Governments criminalized them, and research all but stopped. Today, though, interest in the drugs is surging, thanks to some promising scientific studies in the past few years and big injections of cash from investors like Saad Shah. He runs a venture capital fund in Toronto focused on psychedelic medicine.
When we launched last year in February of 2020, there might have been 18 to 24 companies worth looking at in the space, private companies that were looking for capital. Today, there are over 600.
They're betting that psychedelics will one day be legalized for recreational or even therapeutic use. Some of the companies are in drug development and manufacturing. There are companies focused on opioid addiction, on PTSD, on migraines, on inflammation, on hypoxia. There are companies building clinics where a trained therapist would guide you on your psychedelic trip. And then there are your wellness companies, the startups making psilocybin-infused tea or microdosing kits to boost productivity.
It's a bit of the Wild West, and we're very, very early on in the game.
Dr. Gerald Rosenbaum heads the Center for the Neuroscience of Psychedelics at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. He says all the commercial activity is staggering.
I've never seen anything quite like this in my 4 or 5 decades of being involved in psychiatric drug development.
He says some of the hype is being driven by investors looking for the next big thing, hoping that psychedelics, if they're legalized, of course, will be the next cannabis or cryptocurrency.
People with money have tremendous FOMO about missing out on this opportunity.
But the science on psychedelics is still in its early stages. Numerous studies have shown that psychedelics like LSD and psilocybin are not addictive and don't cause organ damage. but experts say they could still prove risky for some populations, including those with heart problems or severe psychiatric disorders. And there's lots we don't know, says Dr. Rosenbaum, like the effects of psychedelics on the developing brains of adolescents.
You know, is there a potential of downstream unwanted effects? And those are things I think some people are optimistic that's not a big risk, but I don't think we know enough yet to be comfortable.
The other thing that's up in the air? The drug's legal status. The psychedelic sector is at the mercy of regulators who might or might not make hallucinogens legal. Danny Motika is optimistic the drugs will be approved, and so is Saj Shah.
The psychedelics renaissance movement is big, and nothing can stand in the way of that now.
But if he's wrong, well, that's 600 companies that have just lost a very expensive bet. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Tomorrow, we've got a special Christmas Eve edition of the show for you, Joy to the World and Joy on the World, a collection of uplifting stories from the past year. Yesterday on the show, we took you to the Holy Land, where Christmas celebrations are a different and more muted affair this year due to COVID. Reporter Daniela Cheslow played us a song that she was hearing everywhere she went in the historically Christian cities of Nazareth and Bethlehem, Leilat Eid. It was originally recorded in 1977 by Fairuz, the great Lebanese singer. Her husband, Asi Rabbani, and his brother wrote the new lyrics to Jingle Bells, very much in keeping with the Christmas spirit. The friends all gather round, the gifts behind the door. A tree is in the house and children run around. We want to close the show today by setting the mood for the next few nights with this song, also performed by Fairuz. This is Salt El Eid, which translates as Sound of the Holiday. زهر الليل صوت العيد ضوء الليل موجي يا سما بالعناقيد. Silent Night, reworked in Arabic by Lebanon's grand dame of song, Fairuz. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Keep calm and carry on. We'll be back with you here tomorrow.